Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If you don't like pigeons, you have no one to blame but your ancestors. Thousands of years ago, says author Courtney Humphreys, humans domesticated wild, cliff-dwelling rock doves. And ever since then, the stories of people and pigeons have been intertwined, from ancient Egypt to Victorian England to the streets of modern American cities. They've served generals, inspired Charles Darwin, and sometimes it seems they are everywhere. This hour On Point, the amazing success story of the common pigeon. Joining me now in our studio is science writer Courtney Humphreys. She's written about biology, health, and the environment for numerous publications, including Newsweek, Harvard Magazine, and the Boston Globe. Her new book is Superdove: How the Pigeon Took Manhattan and the World. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Courtney Humphreys, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write about and study the pigeon?
Well, you know, I, like most people, I have seen pigeons everywhere, and I hadn't really thought about them much. I'm not a birder. I didn't really know a lot about pigeons. But you know, what got me thinking about them was traveling to different countries and just noticing that whether I was in Europe or South America or Asia, no matter what city I went to, they just seemed to have these pigeons. Mm-hmm. And you know, it got me thinking, how do these pigeons get to be everywhere? Are they really the same? Is it the same species? You know, what's their story? So I kind of was thinking about that. And then I happened to come across Darwin's Origin of Species, which, you know, is this famous book in science. And I was completely baffled because he started the book talking at length about pigeons. And yeah. I just couldn't figure out why that was, but suddenly they just seemed a little more intriguing to me.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You say it's in your book. They captured the heart of Charles Darwin, right?
He
wrote about them, his pigeon fancy and 9 pairs of distinct varieties that Charles Darwin had of pigeons.
Yes, he actually set up a little aviary in his yard and started breeding his own pigeons. And, you know, part of they did become a bit of an obsession with him, but they were also a big part of his work leading up to Origin of Species. Mm.
So Charles Darwin aside, you were very honest in the book to say that you were had a sort of superficial view of pigeons before you wrote this book, and your perceptions changed, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, you know, pigeons, they seem uninteresting because they're so common and because they're everywhere. But, you know, I realized that that's actually kind of what makes them interesting. They're really a success story. You know, we always hear about animals that are endangered or threatened in some way, you know, but what about these animals that just seem to thrive in today's world? So, you know, as I started doing some research on pigeons, I just found this really fascinating history.
Mm. Let's set the record straight. Pigeons are actually doves.
Well, I mean, yes and no. They're for a long time known as rock doves. That was their common name. And the words pigeon and dove were used interchangeably. So it's kind of confusing because nowadays there are certain bird species like mourning doves, which are considered doves. You know, but pigeons and doves, they were once seen as the same thing. And so when you look at iconography from Christianity, where you have the dove of peace. That was actually a pigeon.
Right, not pigeons of peace.
Right.
Right.
So we don't think of them that way.
A marketing appeal problem, right?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So take us into your research, Courtney Humphreys, through your travels to study the origin and the history of the pigeon. You went to Venice, the Piazza San Marco, no? To look at the throngs of street pigeons.
Yeah, and you know, and I did some other research too. I actually also went to Sardinia, where I found I was looking at wild pigeons, which still live on cliffs, rocky cliffs, in Sardinia there. And that was interesting because, you know, we don't really think of these birds as real, real birds, you know,
yeah.
But they did, they got their start, living on cliff sides, mostly in coastal areas, around the Mediterranean, in Europe, in the Middle East, and parts of Africa. And but what happened was they were domesticated very early. They might have been even the first bird to be domesticated thousands of years ago. So they have a really long history living with people.
Hmm. And so those limestone cliffs that you mentioned in Sardinia, it makes them, I guess, perfect to transport to a city like New York with those tall buildings.
Yeah, and that's the thing with pigeons is that it just so happens that, you know, people have built things that mimic cliffs in really good ways. So even though pigeons were domesticated, you know, and brought everywhere that people were, they have been able to live on their own in cities because they can find such good homes there.
Talk more about the domestication of pigeons.
Well, you know, they were used as food, and they still are, not quite as much as they used to be. But
squab?
Right, yeah, squab. And it's often been considered a delicacy. But obviously they were used for food, you know, even early in our history, and they were symbols of fertility, peace, fidelity in different cultures. They were used as messengers in wartime and in peacetime. And then they're also just used as pets. They were there's fancy breeds of pigeons that have been bred in all shapes and sizes, and those have been used for show. So they've had a lot of uses throughout history. But, you know, in more recent times, they've transitioned from being a completely domesticated bird to what we call a feral animal, which is, you know, now living wild alongside us. Mm.
Who knew that pigeons were war heroes? You mentioned briefly here. So tell us the story related to that. The story, I think, of the book, Cher Ami.
Yes. So, yes, they're actually, you know, pigeons were used as messengers in wartime, even in, you know, ancient history. But during World War I and World War II, they were really, they really became part of the military. There were pigeon services. There were, you know, people were trained to keep care for the pigeons. And one of these birds was Cher Ami, who was actually a war hero in World War I. It was a British bird, but it was credited with saving nearly 200 American lives. Hmm. And what happened is this battalion got separated. They weren't able to send communications to ask for help. So they sent Cher Ami. The bird was actually struck by shrapnel that tore his leg. He managed to make this 40-kilometer trip back to his home loft to deliver the message. So there were actually birds in World War II that were given a Medal of Honor in the British Army.
Yes, the British Medal of Bravery for animals, given to a pigeon named G.I. Joe.
Yes, yeah, he was one of the many recipients of that medal.
Saved an entire infantry division, what, by warning off an airstrike?
Yes, yeah, they were about to, they might have gotten struck by their own troops, and so he managed to warn them off just as the planes were getting ready to go.
So all these seemingly heroic acts, and yet you don't tend to think of the pigeon as, well, how should I say, perhaps the smartest bird around?
Yes, well, you know, and I actually got different comments on that. You know, there were certain scientists I talked to who said that pigeons were notoriously stupid. But, you know, a lot of the scientists I spoke to who actually keep pigeons, and of course anybody who breeds pigeons, has a lot to say about how smart they are. And they really have a lot of social intelligence. I mean, having lived with people for thousands of years, they have a really good sense. They recognize people. They know if you've fed them or if you've not fed them. So they actually... they're actually a little smarter than they look.
Speaking of feeding, you say in the book that a huge percentage of food that nurtures urban flocks of pigeons comes from a tiny group of pigeon feeders. You call them, well, mostly women, so they're pigeon mothers,
Yes, that was a German term that I found because I went to Switzerland to look at a pigeon control program there that actually was very effective. But the reason it was effective was because it controlled the people rather than the pigeons. And what they found was that a lot of the reason why pigeons become so overpopulated in some cities is that there are a few, a small number of people who feed pigeons a lot. And, you know, I originally thought of feeding pigeons as, you know, tossing a crust of bread to a bird in the park. I didn't think it was a big deal.
Yeah.
But what I found is that there really are people, a small group of people who really feed pigeons a lot every day. And they're almost like caretakers of these pigeons, and they get these huge flocks. And I've seen it in Boston. You know, there's certain places where there's tons of pigeons everywhere, and there's people who feed them every day.
And you say in the book, when those feedings stop, pigeon populations drop dramatically.
Yes, well, that's what happened in Switzerland. The problem there is convincing people not to feed the pigeons, because people really have a lot of different ideas of what pigeons' place is in our society. You know, some people do see them as pests. They would just rather get rid of them. Other people, they really feel like pigeons need our help, that they need food, they need to be cared for. You know, they were domesticated for a long time. So a lot of people see them as almost like domesticated birds living in the city.
So from what you're saying, I'm hearing that the pigeons' rise is inextricably linked to humans, really.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And that's kind of what the super dove of the title came from. It was it's actually a word I saw in a scientific book on pigeons, and it was kind of used jokingly, but it was talking about why feral pigeons that live in streets are so successful, and that people actually had a role in making them as successful as they are.
I love the cover. Speaking of it, describe it.
well, it's a pigeon with, I guess, a really muscular torso. Yeah, it's a striking image.
We're speaking this hour with Courtney Humphreys, author of Super Dove, How the Pigeon Took Manhattan and the World. We have so many calls lined up here. I want to get to some of them right now. First, in Arlington, Massachusetts, Terry is on the line. Hi, Terry. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My dad was a first generation Italian immigrant and grew up on Orleans Street in East Boston.
Mm.
And he used to have a pet pigeon. He had two of them, I think, but he had one that he was really fond of. He used to wear a little patch over his eye because he had an eye injury, and he used to go around with this pigeon trained on his shoulder as if he was a pirate. And one day he could not find his pigeon, and he didn't find out. I remember my grandmother telling him, we were all sitting at the table, that she had actually killed that pigeon and fed it to him.
Oh, no.
for dinner, a little nice little pigeon soup.
Oh.
Because she couldn't take it anymore. He just brought that pigeon everywhere, and and that was in the 40s. So, you know, pigeons they may still be domesticated and trained here in the Boston area, but I remember feeling so bad for my dad when he found out. You know, he literally looked at his mother across the table as if he was still only 14 years old about that poor pigeon.
All these years later, you still remember. Terry, thank you. That's a great story. I appreciate it. You took your first taste of pigeon or squab at a swanky restaurant in Boston nearby.
Yes, I did. You know, I felt like it was important to actually try them. You know, I'd never eaten pigeon before. And I was a little worried that I'd feel kind of weird about it after studying pigeons for so long. But
did you?
But they're actually really good. So I got over it pretty quickly. They're a dark meat bird, not fatty like duck, but very rich tasting. But you know, I am sorry about that story. You would not want to eat a pigeon that you know was your companion. So.
Is squab popular per se?
You know, it used to be more popular. It's definitely. You know, it's used in French cuisine, Italian cuisine, and actually in, you know, Moroccan cuisine. A lot of Asian cultures still use squab. In China, squab is a delicacy. So it's been used all over. Here, it's definitely not as popular as it used to be, probably because, you know, people associate pigeons with grime and dirt of the city, but but it's still, you know, you still see it in as a delicacy. It's very good, so.
Mm. Here's another call from Orleans, Massachusetts. Kevin is waiting on the line. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for your call.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. If you transported a street pigeon from Provincetown up at the tip of Cape Cod down to New York City, could they navigate their way back to Provincetown?
Hmm. Well, you know, and a lot of people know about these homing pigeons, which are, you know, taken on races. They're able to find their way home over hundreds of miles. And so, I've heard that question of can an ordinary street pigeon do this? Well, it can. There, you know, the ability to home is something that's common to all pigeons.
So it's a natural instinct.
It is a natural instinct.
It's not that they were bred for that, per se.
Right, and that's the thing. They're homing pigeons are bred, you know, to be good flyers, strong flyers, and they're also trained. So what the difference is motivation. Homing pigeons are trained, you know, from the time they're young to return home to get food. And so even if they're taken hundreds of miles away, they will fly all day just to get home, to get to their loft. The problem with a street pigeon is it's not quite so motivated. So I think people have done these studies, and they are able to home. But, you know, a lot of times they see somewhere they want to go, and they just stop and go there. So they're not always quite as motivated as the homing pigeons are.
That's interesting. Let's go to another call now. Sandy is in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sandy. Hi, Jane. I'm on my cell phone, and okay. So I hope you can hear me. I have a wonderful rush of memories hearing about this subject. My grandparents both hailed from Italy and settled in Boston, in Boston's Little Italy, which is known as the North End.
Yeah.
And they raised pigeons in a lovely little pigeon coop on the top of their flat-roofed apartment building. And they had that coop there for well over 50 years before they passed away. And it was just generation after generation of pigeons. My grandparents did eat the pigeons regularly. I could never bring myself to try it, although it always smelled so good the way my grandmother would cook them. But my grandfather would have us join him up on the roof, and he'd open huge sacks of pigeon feed, and that's what it was titled. And we would get to feed the birds. We were allowed to hold the baby birds and stroke them and be very gentle. We were taught how to handle them. And it just was such a special part of my upbringing. Ah,
that's a wonderful story. Sandy, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, I hear this from people where they have these memories of either pigeons that were homing pigeons or pigeons that were, you know, raised for food and kept. It was just much more of a tradition in the past. And it was very easy, you know, to have a backyard coop where you could keep a few pigeons. It was sort of a, you know, an easy source of protein for people. And we've sort of lost that sense of what pigeons are.
I'd like to bring another voice now into our conversation. Joining us from Gilroy, California, is John Heppner. He's the president of the National Pigeon Association and an award-winning pigeon breeder who's been raising and showing the birds for over 50 years. John Heppner, welcome to On Point.
Hi, good to be here.
Glad you're with us. How is it that you started breeding pigeons?
Well, I was actually introduced to pigeons. These were common pigeons, but my grandfather bred them for color and housed them in his barn. This was in Manitoba, Canada, and he also ate them, but I used to stay at his house, and the pigeons would eat in the garden, and they were so very tame, and that kind of endeared them to me and all their different colors, and actually, I try to keep them flying. They'd only land at certain spots. I'm amazed I didn't become a racing homer enthusiast, but I raise the fancy pigeons, yes.
Well, talk about that. You are proud to say that you have improved a particular breed of pigeon more than anybody else. How so?
Well, yeah, it's this type of bird is called an English trumpeter. It has a unique voice. It drums and trumpets differently than the common bird, and it's got up to 6-inch feathers on the feet, and a little cap or crest on its head, and a little tuft of feathers, reverse growth just above the beak. And it's a shapely bird, and I guess it's the excessive feathers on the feet that endeared them to me as just a young boy. And I got into that breed and studied the standard, and I was in Canada, in Saskatchewan at the time, but I knew that the hotbed for that breed was in Los Angeles area. And eventually I shipped some birds down there on the plane. Today we have very fancy carrying boxes, but I shipped them in some banana boxes, and I won a whole lot of awards. and was a new sensation in that particular breed, and I've just seemed to have a knack to understand and to breed that bird according to the standard of perfection.
So tell us about the show circuit for pigeon breeding. Is it popular? Is it hot these days?
Well, the National Pigeon Association has about 2,000 members across the country, and there will be a show in New York and Scarsdale. It's called the Big Apple Invitational, a new show, the second week in December. And our big national show will be in Pennsylvania this year in January. So, and Louisville has a national young bird show each year that has about 5, 6, close to 7,000 just young birds of that year in many different breeds.
Mm. So what are the idiosyncrasies of the pigeon that make them so unique and so special to your mind, John Hebner?
Well, as a youngster, what I was really enamored with is how similar they were to people. I had them in my father's barn, and I had nest boxes up there, and I'd sit there for 4 hours on a Sunday afternoon just observing them, taking care of their own local location, like their nest box, and keeping other intruders out, and feeding their babies, and sometimes a fight would ensue, and certain breeds of pigeons would joust a little differently than others, and they just seemed to be so interesting to watch. The male would sit on the eggs, and the male also feeds the babies pigeon milk, as does the mother, and it was just fascinating to me to see their whole societal setup, and I just branched out from there. At that time, I didn't even know there were all these many different fancy breeds, which I came to learn later in life, or actually as a young man.
Well, John Hebner, it's been great to hear your experiences and your perspective. Thank you so much for joining us from Gilroy, California today.
It's been a delight, and I certainly enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. All the best to you, sir. John Hebner, president of the National Pigeon Association, breeding pigeons for over 50 years now. Let's go back to the phones. Vince is in Mullins, South Carolina. Hi, Vince. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jay.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm an amateur pigeon control guy. I go to farms.
Okay.
And I shoot the pigeons in the barns.
Yeah?
And because the farmers asked me to.
I see.
And and occasionally I'll kill a banded pigeon. And recently I've got on the internet and discovered that I could find out where these pigeons were banded, and the owner of the pigeon. And I've contacted some of the owners, and I'll tell them what happened to their pigeon.
So they're following them around. They know where they're going because of you.
Well, a lot of those are probably, homing pigeons all have bands on their legs. And a lot of times, you know, people are racing these pigeons all over the place, and they lose pigeons. Sometimes the pigeons get caught up in bad weather. Sometimes they just, give up, I think. But a lot of times you will see a pigeon with a little band around its leg, and it is usually a homing pigeon that belongs to somebody. But they all have an identifier on them, and so you can actually sometimes contact the, kind of a local racing pigeon association and find out who it belongs to and contact them.
When the Europeans brought their homing pigeons to New York City, what happened?
Well, homing pigeons racing pigeons is still popular. I mean, it's not as much as it used to be, but, back in, the earlier parts of the 20th century, there were people racing pigeons all over. New York City especially is a place where, racing has been very popular. I think that our populations of street pigeons tend to get a lot of homing pigeons in them because of this, because, they're always kind of intermixing.
Let's go back to the phones for some more callers here. Joel is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
Hi.
I, too, find pigeons to be charming and in many ways admirable creatures, but it's a fact of science that they are quite dangerous to humans in that their droppings contain oncogenic viruses, and these are quite dangerous. It's true that the rates of cancer causation from this are rather small, problem is that their droppings tend to turn to powder, which then blow about.
Joel, thanks. Let's ask the expert here. I appreciate your call, Joel.
Well, you know, a lot of people do feel like pigeons are sort of filthy and diseased and things like that. I mean, there's, you know, they do carry certain things that can be transmitted to humans. However, you know, most of the scientists I talked to just said, you know, it's not, you don't see people, you know, getting sick or dying because of pigeons. I mean, the average contact that you would have with a pigeon, this isn't really a problem. It's more if, you know, with the dung, if it starts piling up, getting really unsanitary conditions, let's say if they're living in a apartment building or an air vent or something like that, that's where things get really unsanitary. But, you know, I don't think people really need to worry about, you know, catching diseases from pigeons if they're not coming in close contact with them.
Before we go to the break here, Courtney, you wanted to speak a little bit more to how people have shaped pigeons over the years. I'll give you the chance right now.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the idea that really interested me was the fact that people had such a role in pigeon success. And obviously one of the reasons is because we brought them everywhere. You know, the ones in North America are not native here. They were brought here from Europe. So they were carried all over the world. However, you know, we don't see chickens and pigs and horses and cows running around wild in the cities. It just so happens that that pigeons are very good at living in cities. But people also gave them certain qualities that help them thrive. If you think of a domestic animal, I mean, they're raised to breed a lot. Hmm. They're raised to be hardy animals that can tolerate crowded conditions. They're raised to tolerate people and tolerate noise of being around people. Hmm. And, you know, so pigeons are kind of ideally suited to just be constantly procreating and living in crowded conditions and being around people, which is what, you know, the situation we see in cities a lot. But they never lost the ability to find food on their own. So they are perfectly capable of living wild alongside us.
Hmm. Let's squeeze in another call here before the break. Gerald is in Greenville, South Carolina. Hi, Gerald. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm living in Greenville, South Carolina now, but I used to live in Oceanside, California. My father was in the Marine Corps stationed at Camp Pendleton, and in California there, they had so many pigeons that there were periods of time where they would actually have everyone go in the house, and they would have guys with shotguns come through, and I remember watching it as a kid. These guys would just be blowing the pigeons out of the air, and they'd be all flying and flopping around. That was during the 60s. Like 60, 65, 64, 60, you know, you know, they did that quite often. I mean, it was a couple of times a year they would do that to control the pigeon population. Mm-hmm. You have
Gerald,
a guy on from California. I wonder if you remember that.
Thank you for the call.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, pigeons are one of the few bird species that are not protected by federal laws. So people can, you know, that's why you have pest control people can go out and kill pigeons. There is, you know, some regulation in how they can do it. So most people can't go out and take a shotgun and shoot all the pigeons, you know, in the streets. But controlling pigeons is definitely something that people are able to do if they want to.
Sounds like they have done.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it's a little less wild than it used to be, though.
We're speaking with Courtney Humphreys, the author of Super Dove, How the Pigeon Took Manhattan and the World. We talked a little bit before the break with one of our callers about pigeon control. And I'd like to talk more about that now. Joining me from Bella Vista, Arkansas, is Laura Dobson. She is the president of the Argyle Civic Association in Hollywood, California, and she has been the leader of an innovative attempt to control Los Angeles's pigeon population using pigeon birth control. Laura Dobson, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane.
So how serious was the problem were pigeons in L.A.?
Well, it's probably more serious than you have any idea. We have a lady that, with her own admission, we call her Bird Lady, with her own admission, claims she puts down $65,000 a year worth of bird seed centering on Vine Street from Franklin to Melrose. in probably 20 to 30 different locations.
What does $65,000 worth of birdseed look like?
Tons.
Yeah. And she herself dispenses it around the city?
Oh, yes, she does. Every day in her black Lincoln Navigator set up perfectly for the birdseed.
And how does that attract the pigeons? How many of them?
Well, we don't really have a true count. It'd be impossible to count. They're just everywhere, and they're lining. They line up in the morning on various electrical pole lines, telephone lines, to meet and greet at sunrise and then to eat her food. And that's where you can really see the masses because they're just feather to feather.
So it's not so much the pigeons that that are troublesome. It's what they leave behind, if you will, every year. Can you describe that, Laura?
Our city, Hollywood, is basically whitewashed with pigeon droppings. It just looks so bad. It's on rooftops. It's on light posts. It's on umbrellas. It's on our tablecloths with our outdoor eating. It's on our sidewalks. It is everywhere.
And how difficult is it to clean up?
One owner said he had it 5 feet deep on his rooftop, and he had to take a jackhammer to get it out.
Mm. So what did you determine to do about this?
Well, we knew she wouldn't stop. We tried all sorts of alternatives, and we looked up a lot of information online about what not to do, like kill them, of course. We wanted to figure out a humane way, and we just wasn't finding the answer. So we turned to PETA, and they told us that the EPA was pushing through right now a bird birth control from Enolitex called Oval Control P. That finally got approved, and basically what it does, it's a bird birth control.
Is it pigeon specific?
Yes, that's why the P at the end of the name. It's only made for pigeons, and it's just their size.
And so how do you dispense it?
Various rooftops in the affected area. It goes off in the morning when they want to feed, which is sunrise, and they hear the noise, and they come down and feed every day, and within 5 days, their birth control is working. And it works by messing up the membrane in the egg and making scrambled eggs.
And everybody's happy about this. PETA's happy. You're happy.
Yeah, the Humane Society's happy. And most importantly, we thought it was going to take us years to bring the pigeon problem down. And in the first controlled area that we did, we had 438 birds, and with 5 months, it was down under 40 birds.
So a significant reduction in the pigeon population in a short time.
Way far more successful than we ever even dreamed. We were just elated.
Is this a program that other cities are looking at, or... How are you sharing this wealth, so to speak?
All over the world has been calling me, everywhere, China, Canada. Everyone has been calling on this. Every major city seems to have this problem, and they don't know what to do.
Well, Laura Dodson, what a great story, and thank you for your time telling it to us. Appreciate your time from Bella Vista, Arkansas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura, president of the Argyle Civic Association in Hollywood, California, using pigeon birth control to control the population there. Back to the phones now. Greta is in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Greta. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Enjoying the conversation. And
thank you.
This is not very helpful when you think about pigeon birth control, but we have a delightful children's book that my great aunt wrote, and she lived around the world doing mission work, and mostly in Malaysia and India, and then collected some pictures from other places, too, and compiled them in a book called The Pigeon Lullaby.
Hmm.
And it has a song that goes with it and pictures of it. And we just really enjoyed it with our child, and just wanted to share how, delightful we thought it was.
Oh, that's wonderful, Greta. Thank you. The Pigeon Lullaby. Appreciate the call. Literature? How does that play into pigeon history, Courtney?
Well, like I said, pigeons used to have kind of a better reputation when they were, symbols of peace and goodwill and all those good things. A lot of times, I actually did some literature searches, which is great that you can do now. You can look up all of Dickens online and see what he wrote about pigeons and things like that. But, a lot of times they were a domesticated animal. So they were always talked about in the yards. They were eaten. Pigeon pies were very popular. And so a lot of the older literature on pigeons is just, kind of the literature of livestock animals.
Back to another call now from Rudy, who is in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Rudy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to share a little poignant story about a pigeon that's had me being very fond of pigeons ever since.
Okay.
When I was a gigging musician in Atlanta, Georgia, I was on my way into to a job at Underground Atlanta. I heard this scuffle near the dumpster, and I looked closely, and there was a dead pigeon, and there was a fellow pigeon, his mate or his friend or something. He was covering him with his wing and looking at me very frightened, but he wasn't going to leave his buddy. So I left him alone, went in and played my job, and came out 4 hours later, and he was still there covering his friend. So I've had a top spot for pigeons ever since.
Thanks for the story, Rudy.
Yeah, you know, pigeons do, they do mate for life. And, you know, I've seen similar things. I mean, once you start noticing pigeons, you're just going to see all these things everywhere because, you know, most of the time, I think they're kind of invisible to people. But, you know, just recently I saw something where a pigeon had gotten hit by a car and was lying in the road and its mate was just sort of hanging around like, what's happened, you know? So I can definitely relate.
Who'd have thought, huh? Will is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to find out about something I read about 30 years ago in Reader's Digest. It was in Sports Illustrated, a book-length description of squab catching in Ohio. They would have huge parties of people with people cooking for them and railroad sidings, and they would smoke out squabs up in a tree, and they would all fall into these nets, and they would salt them up and barrel them and ship them around the world to the best restaurants back in the 1880s. Did this actually happen, or was that some kind of a fiction?
Huh. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, you know, you might be talking about passenger pigeons, which, you know, when people first came here, that was the main, you know, pigeon. I mean, the street pigeons we have today, like I said, are not native here, but we had, you know, an amazing amount of passenger pigeons that were just, you know, blanketing the sky whenever they migrated. And that was a real tragedy that people really just killed them, you know, wholesale in these groups because they did nest in trees. And so they could smoke them out of trees. They could net them. They could get these huge flocks and trap them and kill them by the hundreds. So it was kind of a tragedy, but it did make way for for the pigeons that we have now.
That's interesting. Jim is on the line from Indian Land, South Carolina. Hi, Jim. You're on. Are you there, Jim? Are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Go ahead.
When I was a boy back in Pittsburgh in the 30s, a friend of my dad gave me three pigeons, homing pigeons, and I built a coop on the back porch, and I would take them all over the places, and then they would fly back home. Even took them on streetcars. But the trouble is, each time they came home, they would bring buddies along with them. So I ended up with a couple dozen pigeons, and the neighbors all got upset because of their white roosts. So we had to do something with them, and Dad decided that we'd eat them. Well, Mom cooked one of them. And we had it for dinner, but I couldn't even think about eating it because I had them all named and everything like that. And I'm not sure. I think I gave the rest of them back to somebody else who kept them. But that was one of my favorite stories. I must have been about all 8 or 10 years old.
Jim, thanks for the memory. There are a lot of soft spots here.
And
for
a lot of people cooking their pets.
Let's go to another call here. Ralph is in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. My name is Ralph. It's Gus.
Oh, sorry. I've got it here wrong on the screen. Go ahead.
That's okay. My story is about the Japanese concentration camp during World War II. I was born in Indonesia. My father and mother were Dutch. And during war, we were all concentrated into a part of Bandung on Java. Mm. And since there was very little to do, I got interested in pigeons. And a Chinese friend of mine, who, of course, is outside the camp, gave me two pigeons. So I built a pigeon box for them.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, they had a young, which was the most beautiful pigeon I've ever seen. It was white and black wings, and it had a tuft.
Mm.
And so in those days, we were still allowed to go in and out of the camp. So I bicycled to the bird market and bought a mate for him. And so started a group of pigeons. So at first I built one box and then two boxes, and finally ended up building a whole pigeon house, which was great, except that we had cats in the camp, which weren't fed, so they would come around and kill a pigeon now and then. But my experience was that those pigeons were fantastic flyers. He would go up in the morning and spiral up to maybe 200-300 feet in the air, and just circle around and then dive and then go up again and dive again. It was just fantastic to see. Until one of them smashed into the roof, and it was one of the most beautiful pigeons, and I was very sorry. But it didn't last very long because the Japs were afraid we were using them for messages. So one day the Japs came in and they took away all my pigeons, which was a bad day for me, and I still remember it.
Well, Gus, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. You know, hearing his description of the pigeon, the white pigeon with the black tuft, it makes me wonder if there's an unusual amount of variation in pigeons, especially pigeon breeding, in terms of the feather mops and the long necks and all of that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, even actually, even street pigeons are incredibly diverse. I mean, I think that, you know, people don't always realize. I mean, they're in terms of their coloration, they're incredibly diverse, and a lot of that came from the fact that they were domesticated. So there's all these interesting color genetics flying, you know, going through the population. But yeah, the fancy pigeons. I think a lot of people don't really know that these breeds exist. And when John Hebner was talking about his pigeons, I mean, probably the most fun I had in researching this book was going to these fancy pigeon shows, because they're just wild. I mean, these birds, they're all shapes and sizes. They don't, you know, some of them don't even, you wouldn't recognize them as pigeons.
Because why? Colors. What do they look like?
Well, you know, some of them are they go from 4 ounces to 4 pounds. You know, some of them are, they look like hens. Some of them look like other kinds of birds. Some of them have these feathers that encircle their whole head, so you can't even see the head. I mean, you know, when you think about dogs as being like the Chihuahua and the Great Dane and all these different things, pigeons are pretty close to that. Mm. So, you know, I have to put a plug in for going to some of these shows, because they're really interesting.
Hmm. Let's squeeze in another couple of calls here if we can. John is in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, John. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
And I did have a question, and that was, I read a long time ago that a lot of hawks or falcons were moving into the big cities, particularly New York, and that they were, their primary food source was now pigeons. I wondered if they had heard about that. Is that true?
So I think John's question is breaking up a little bit, is if the primary food source for falcons and hawks in places like New York, where they have begun to congregate, is the big food source pigeons.
Well, definitely. You know, pigeons are, especially with when you're talking about falcons, they're making a comeback around here. And, you know, they're, pigeons and falcons have kind of an ancient history as predator and prey. So you know, when you're talking about pigeons being good flyers, well, there's a reason for that. It's because they're trying to get away from falcons and also hawks and things like that. So they're definitely more of those birds of prey. You know, I did talk to somebody in Massachusetts about how it's not just pigeons that they're eating, because pigeons are actually really good at getting away. And so he was saying a lot of the peregrine falcons here actually prefer to get these little migratory birds that are just flying from one place to the other, because they're not as good as getting away from them as pigeons are.
Interesting. I want to squeeze in one last call here from Charlene, who's in Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Charlene. Welcome.
Hi.
I have to ask you to be brief. We don't have much time left. Go ahead.
There was a romance between my father and mother. My father lived in Kentucky. His brother worked in Louisiana. This is in the early 1920s.
Yeah.
He shipped one of his pigeons that the two of them had trained as boys to Louisiana to my mother. She put a love note in the band on its leg, a little capsule, and it made its way back to my father in Kentucky.
A love note via pigeon. Charlene, thanks for the call. It's a great one. So wrap us up here in our last 20 seconds. Courtney Humphreys, this book, Super Dove and Pigeons. What do you want us to know that we might not have learned this hour?
Well, you know, I think we talked about a lot. I think I just to me, pigeons were just sort of this everyday common thing that that I didn't really think about, and I just assumed they were kind of boring. But I just uncovered this fascinating history about them, and so. So I think the main thing I wanted to do with this book was just to show, you know, not to proselytize pigeon love to everybody, but, you know, just to show that they do have a really fascinating history.
Well, Courtney Humphreys, how great to have you here, author of the book Super Dove, How the Pigeon Took Manhattan and the World. I'll think of pigeons in a totally different way now. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Her words are simple and few. Listen, listen, she's calling to you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence.